Chapter 13. I am very glad indeed to introduce these young people to you, and at the same time, get acquainted with them myself. I have seen them more than once for a moment, but have not had the privilege of knowing them personally as intimately as I wanted to. I saw them first, a great many years ago, when Mr. Barnum had them, and they were just fresh from Siam. The ligature was their best hold then, the literature became their best hold later, when one of them committed an indiscretion, and they had to cut the old bond to accommodate the sheriff. In that old former time this one was Chang, that one was Eng. The sympathy existing between the two was most extraordinary. It was so fine, so strong, so subtle, that what the one ate the other digested. When one slept, the other snored. If one sold a thing, the other scooped the usufruct. This independent and yet dependent action was observable in all the details of their daily life. I mean this quaint and arbitrary distribution of originating cause and resulting effect between the two - between, I may say, this dynamo and the other always motor, or, in other words, that the one was always the creating force, the other always the utilizing force. No, for while it is true that within certain well-defined zones of activity the one was always dynamo, and the other always motor, within certain other well-defined zones these positions became exactly reversed. For instance, in moral matters Mr. Chang Riley was always dynamo, Mr. Eng Nai was always motor. For while Mr. Chang Riley had a high, in fact, an abnormally high and fine moral sense, he had no machinery to work it with, whereas Mr. Eng Nai, who hadn't any moral sense at all, and hasn't yet, was equipped with all the necessary plant for putting a noble deed through, if he could only get the inspiration on reasonable terms outside. In intellectual matters, on the other hand, Mr. Eng Nai was always dynamo, Mr. Chang Riley was always motor. Mr. Eng Nai had a stately intellect, but couldn't make it go. Mr. Chang Riley hadn't, but could. That is to say, that while Mr. Chang Riley couldn't think things himself, he had a marvelous natural grace in setting them down and weaving them together, when his pal furnished the raw material. Thus, working together, they made a strong team. Laboring together, they could do miracles, but break the circuit, and both were impotent. It has remained so to this day. They must travel together, hoe, and plant, and plow, and reap, and sell their public together, or there's no result. I have made this explanation, this analysis, this vivisection, so to speak, in order that you may enjoy these delightful adventurers understandingly. When Mr. Eng Nai's deep and broad, and limpid philosophies flow by in front of you, refreshing all the regions round about with their gracious floods, you will remember that it isn't his water, it's the other man's, and he is only working the pump. And when Mr. Chang Riley enchants your ear, and soothes your spirit, and touches your heart with the sweet, and genuine music of his poetry as sweet, and as genuine as any that his friends, the birds and the bees, make about his other friends, the woods and the flowers, you will remember, while placing justice where justice is due, that it isn't his music, but the other man's, he is only turning the crank. I beseech for these visitors a fair field, a single-minded, one-eyed umpire, and a score bulletin baron of goose eggs, if they earn it, and I judge they will, and hope they will. Mr. James Whitcomb Chang Riley will now go to the bat. Dinner to Whitelaw Reed, address at the dinner in honor of Ambassador Reed, given by the Pilgrims Club of New York on February 19, 1908. I am very proud to respond to this toast, as it recalls the proudest day of my life. The delightful hospitality shown me at the time of my visit to Oxford I shall cherish until I die. In that long and distinguished career of mine I value that degree above all other honors. When the ship landed even the stevedores gathered on the shore, and gave an English cheer. Nothing could surpass in my life the pleasure of those 4 weeks. No one could pass by me without taking my hand, even the policeman. I've been in all the principal capitals of Christendom in my life, and have always been an object of interest to policemen. Sometimes there was suspicion in their eyes, but not always. With their puissant hand they would hold up the commerce of the world to let me pass. I noticed in the papers this afternoon a dispatch from Washington, saying that Congress would immediately pass a bill restoring to our gold coinage the motto, "En God We Trust." I'm glad of that. I'm glad of that. I was troubled when that motto was removed. Sure enough, the prosperities of the whole nation went down in a heap when we ceased to trust in God in that conspicuously advertised way. I knew there would be trouble. And if Pierpont Morgan hadn't stepped in, Bishop Lawrence may now add to his message to the old country that we are now trusting in God again. So we can discharge Mr. Morgan from his office with honor. Mr. Reed said an hour or so ago something about my ruining my activities last summer. They are not ruined, they are renewed. I am stronger now, much stronger. I suppose that the spiritual uplift I received increased my physical power more than anything I ever had before. I was dancing last night at 1:30 o'clock. Mr. Choate has mentioned Mr. Reed's predecessors. Mr. Choate's head is full of history, and some of it is true too. I enjoyed hearing him tell about the list of the men who had the place before he did. He mentioned a long list of those predecessors, people I never heard of before, and elected 5 of them to the presidency by his own vote. I'm glad and proud to find Mr. Reed in that high position, because he didn't look it when I knew him 40 years ago. I was talking to Reed the other day, and he showed me my autograph on an old paper 20 years old. I didn't know I had an autograph 20 years ago. Nobody ever asked me for it. I remember a dinner I had long ago with Whitelaw Reed and John Hay at Reed's expense. I had another last summer, when I was in London at the embassy, that Choate laggered so. I'd like to live there. Some people say they couldn't live on the salary, but I could live on the salary and the nation together. Some of us don't appreciate what this country can do. There's John Hay, Reed, Choate, and me. This is the only country in the world where youth, talent, and energy can reach such heights. It shows what we could do without means, and what people can do with talent and energy when they find it in people like us. When I first came to New York, they were all struggling young men, and I am glad to see that they have got on in the world. I knew John Hay when I had no white hairs in my head, and more hair than Reed has now. Those were days of joy and hope. Reed and Hay were on the staff of the Tribune. I went there once in that old building, and I looked all around, and I finally found a door ajar and looked in. It wasn't Reed or Hay there, but it was Horace Greeley. Those were in the days when Horace Greeley was a king. That was the first time I ever saw him and the last. I was admiring him when he stopped and seemed to realize that there was a fine presence there somewhere. He tried to smile, but he was out of smiles. He looked at me a moment and said, "What in H- do you want?" He began with that word. That's a long word and a profane word. I don't remember what the word was now, but I recognized the power of it. I had never used that language myself, but at that moment I was converted. It has been a great refuge for me in time of trouble. If a man doesn't know that language, he can't express himself on strenuous occasions. When you have that word at your command, let trouble come. But later Hay rose, and you know what summit Whitelaw Reed has reached, and you see me. Those two men have regulated troubles of nations and conferred peace upon mankind. And in my humble way, of which I am quite vain, I was the principal moral force in all those great international movements. These great men illustrated what I say. Look at us great people, we all come from the dregs of society. That's what can be done in this country. That's what this country does for you. Choate here, he hasn't got anything to say, but he says it just the same, and he can do it so felicitously too. I said long ago he was the handsomest man America ever produced. May the progress of civilization always rest on such distinguished men as it has in the past. Rogers and Railroads, at a banquet given Mr. H. H. Rogers by the businessmen of Norfolk, VI, celebrating the opening of the Virginian Railway, April 3, 1909, Toastmaster. Have often thought that when the time comes, which must come to all of us, when we reach that great way in the great beyond, and the question is propounded, what have you done to gain admission into this great realm? ... If the answer could be sincerely made, I have made men laugh, ... It would be the surest passport to a welcome entrance. We have here tonight one who has made millions laugh, not the loud laughter that bespeaks the vacant mind, but the laugh of intelligent mirth that helps the human heart and the human mind. I refer, of course, to Dr. Clemens. I was going to say Mark Twain, his literary title, which is a household phrase in more homes than that of any other man, and you know him best by that dear old title. I thank you, Mr. Toastmaster, for the compliment which you have paid me, and I am sure I would rather have made people laugh than cry, yet in my time I have made some of them cry, and before I stop entirely I hope to make some more of them cry. I like compliments. I deal in them myself. I have listened with the greatest pleasure to the compliments which the chairman has paid to Mr. Rogers, and that road of his tonight, and I hope some of them are deserved. It is no small distinction to a man like that to sit here before an intelligent crowd like this, and to be classed with Napoleon and Caesar. Why didn't he say that this was the proudest day of his life? Napoleon and Caesar are dead, and they can't be here to defend themselves. But I'm here. The chairman said, and very truly, that the most lasting thing in the hands of man are the roads which Caesar built, and it is true that he built a lot of them, and they are there yet. Yes, Caesar built a lot of roads in England, and you can find them. But Rogers has only built one road, and he hasn't finished that yet. I like to hear my old friend complimented, but I don't like to hear it overdone. I didn't go around today with the others, to see what he is doing. I will do that in a quiet time, when there is not anything going on, and when I shall not be called upon to deliver intemperate compliments on the railroad in which I own no stock. They proposed that I go along with the committee, and help inspect that dump down yonder. I didn't go. I saw that dump. I saw that thing when I was coming in on the steamer, and I didn't go because I was diffident, sentimentally diffident, about going and looking at that thing again, that great, long, bony thing. It looked just like Mr. Rogers' foot. The chairman says Mr. Rogers is full of practical wisdom, and he is. It is intimated here that he is a very ingenious man, and he is a very competent financier. Maybe he is now, but it was not always so. I know lots of private things in his life which people don't know, and I know how he started, and it was not a very good start. I could have done better myself. The first time he crossed the Atlantic he had just made the first little strike in oil, and he was so young he did not like to ask questions. He did not like to appear ignorant. To this day he don't like to appear ignorant, but he can look as ignorant as anybody. On board the ship they were betting on the run of the ship, betting a couple of shillings, or half a crown, and they proposed that this youth from the oil regions should bet on the run of the ship. He did not like to ask what a half crown was, and he didn't know. But rather than be ashamed of himself he did bet half a crown on the run of the ship, and in bed he could not sleep. He wondered if he could afford that outlay in case he lost. He kept wondering over it, and said to himself, "Colin, a king's crown must be worth $20, so half a crown would cost $10,000. He could not afford to bet away $10, on the run of the ship, so he went up to the stakeholder, and gave him $150 to let him off. I like to hear Mr. Rogers complimented. I am not stingy in compliments to him myself. Why, I did it today, when I sent his wife a telegram to comfort her. That is the kind of person I am. I knew she would be uneasy about him. I knew she would be solicitous about what he might do down here, so I did it to quiet her, and to comfort her. I said he was doing well for a person out of practice. There is nothing like it. He is like I used to be. There were times when I was careless in my dress when I got older. You know how uncomfortable your wife can get when you are going away without her superintendence. Once when my wife could not go with me, she always went with me. When she could, I always did meet that kind of luck. I was going to Washington once, a long time ago, in Mr. Cleveland's first administration, and she could not go. But, in her anxiety that I should not desecrate the house, she made preparation. She knew that there was to be a reception of those authors at the White House at 7 o'clock in the evening. She said, if I should tell you now what I want to ask of you, you would forget it before you get to Washington, and, therefore, I have written it on a card, and you will find it in your dress vest pocket when you are dressing at the Arlington, when you are dressing to see the president. I never thought of it again until I was dressing, and I felt in that pocket and took it out, and it said, in a kind of imploring way, don't wear your Arctics in the White House. You complimented Mr. Rogers on his energy, his foresightedness, complimented him in various ways, and he has deserved those compliments, although I say it myself, and I enjoy them all. There is one side of Mr. Rogers that has not been mentioned. If you will leave that to me, I will touch upon that. There was a note in an editorial in one of the Norfolk papers this morning that touched upon that very thing, that hidden side of Mr. Rogers, where it spoke of Helen Keller and her affection for Mr. Rogers, to whom she dedicated her life book. And as he has a right to feel that way, because, without the public knowing anything about it, he rescued, if I may use that term, that marvelous girl, that wonderful southern girl, that girl who was stone deaf, blind, and dumb from scarlet fever when she was a baby 18 months old, and who now is as well and thoroughly educated as any woman on this planet at 29 years of age. She is the most marvelous person of her sex that has existed on this earth since Joan of Arc. That is not all Mr. Rogers has done, but you never see that side of his character, because it is never protruding, but he lends a helping hand daily out of that generous heart of his. You never hear of it. He is supposed to be a moon which has one side dark and the other bright. But the other side, though you don't see it, is not dark. It is bright, and its rays penetrate, and others do see it who are not God. I would take this opportunity to tell something that I have never been allowed to tell by Mr. Rogers, either by my mouth or in print, and if I don't look at him, I can tell it now. In 1893, when the publishing company of Charles 50, Webster, of which I was financial agent, failed, it left me heavily in debt. If you will remember what commerce was at that time, you will recall that you could not sell anything, and could not buy anything, and I was on my back. My books were not worth anything at all, and I could not give away my copyrights. Mr. Rogers had long enough vision ahead to say, your books have supported you before, and after the panic is over they will support you again, and that was a correct proposition. He saved my copyrights, and saved me from financial ruin. He it was who arranged with my creditors to allow me to roam the face of the earth for 4 years, and persecute the nations thereof with lectures, promising that at the end of 4 years I would pay dollar for dollar. That arrangement was made, otherwise I would now be living out of doors under an umbrella, and a borrowed one at that. You see his white mustache and his head trying to get white,
he is always. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.